Hello, and welcome to Pod Space Nine, the last stop for trash in the Alpha Quadrant. This is a rewatch podcast for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, featuring two veteran viewers and one newbie. My name is Justin, and I'll be your away team commander. Joining me is my science officer, Anna, with our acting ensign, Jude. Which alien species would you least like to be forcibly transformed into?
Ooh.
What species do I find most viscerally unpleasant?
I feel like I would, in fact, possibly go for Cardassians just because, like, the whole Cardassian thing. Also, like, just one of the ones where, like, you know, you need, like, some sort of breathing apparatus or something like that to, like, survive in the atmosphere.
Okay.
Not Ferengi. I feel like Ferengi would be a go-to for any woman. I think for me,
just wait until we meet Moogie.
Okay, fair enough. There's so many aliens in Star Trek.
Okay, I do have a real answer. So remember that episode of Next Generation where Riker plays like space chess with the jackass who
the Zach Dorn?
The Zach Dorn. I'm going to go with that.
Okay.
But yes, that's my answer. The Zach Dorn.
You don't want to be an insufferable nerd?
No. That is my life already.
An insufferable war game nerd specifically.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't want to be turned into a Warhammer player.
Thank you, Justin. You have succinctly summarized my thought process there.
Listen, I thought you were going to say you don't want to be turned into silver.
As a former Warhammer, I understand this.
But see, okay. No, see, the Zach Dorn aren't silver because the Zach Dorn are not fun.
Okay, fair enough. Okay. I think for me, it would be, is it the Gorn that are the lizard ones?
Yeah.
But specifically the TNG Gorn, not the Discovery Gorn.
Original series
Gorn. Not TNG, TOS Gorn.
Oh yeah, the rubber lizard suit.
Rubber lizard suit wearing a Tarzan onesie.
I don't know. That's that little Tarzan onesie is pretty. That's pretty fly.
That just because everything about that creature looks uncomfortable, ill moving, and frankly ill suited to life. And it feels like. Can you imagine being a species that's that wretched, except you've been surgically altered into it, so you're like even less adapted, you're even more maladapted to existence.
So my answer is somewhat similar to that.
What would you go for, Justin?
The Vorta.
we will
get into the pain that is being a Vorta as we go along in the show, but I can't think of a species I would less like to be than a Vorta.
What is a Vorta?
You're right.
The Iris species, part of the Dominion.
Oh, one of the ones with the weird ears.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They like, because once you find out that they're, you know, once you find out, no, they are not the founders. I'm not going to go into details, but their job is basically butt monkeys of the Dominion.
They are the middle managers.
It really is. Like, biologically, there's nothing wrong with being a Vorta, but socially, you are in hell.
That's reasonable. My backup answer would have been disco Klingons, just because it looks very busy.
All right, folks. Tonight we are talking about season 3, episodes 5 and 6 of DS9, Second Skin and The Abandoned. I have Second Skin, so I will take this away. This was written by Robert Hewitt Wolf and directed by Les Landau. We start at the Replimat, where Dax is waiting on Kira, who is not a fan of holosuites. As Kira is looking forward to their hover sailing adventure, she's contacted by a Bajoran historian who wants to know if she was at the Elmspur detention center. Kira says she was never at Elmspur, but the historian says, hey, the records say you clearly were. The records also have note of cellmates of hers, who they contact one and seems to remember her, and that they thought she was dead. As she goes to Bajor to investigate, we see a creepy alien tailing her. Bashir and Garrick later talk about traveling, and Garrick rues that he hasn't left the station in 3 years apart from a small drawer because space is dangerous. Bashir is like, no, you're just paranoid.
Also, that trip to Bajor was with Bashir, yeah, too.
The archives contact Sisko, and the historian reports to him that Kira never made their meeting, and she hasn't been able to be contacted. Kira awakens in a dark room. When she sees herself in a mirror, she's a Cardassian. An older man, a Cardassian man, says they have brought her home. He says that he has no intention of hurting her, as she is one of them. He implies that Kira was a former deep cover agent of the Obsidian Order, with her memories altered to make her a better spy. He says that she's been given a medication to reverse her memory loss, but it can take time. Her real name, according to him, was Ileana Gamor, and that she assumed the role of a Bajoran terrorist 10 years ago. He explains that this is the house that she was born in, and it produces a message that she recorded before she left. On the station, Odo and Dax report a transporter trace they found near the archives, and Sisko has them continue the investigation. On Cardassia, the man, Entak, returns with a military officer in tow. He's introduced as Legate Takeni Gamor, her father. Gamor dismisses Entak, and Kira's response to Gamor's courtesy is, well, acrid at best. As Kira searches the room, he says that the surveillance devices aren't on, as he's a member of the Central Command. Gamor and Kira continue to butt heads, and Kira is of the belief this is all a ruse. Gamor apologizes for her distress, and he seems, like, legitimately concerned for her, and that he's very nice to her. He legitimately thinks that she is his daughter. Garrick approaches Bashir in the infirmary to report about Kira. He tells the crew that Kira is being held by the Obsidian Order. Sisko declares that he, Garrick, and Odo would be going to Cardassia on the Defiant. Sisko threatens Garrick with eviction from the station unless he helps rescue Kira. Listen, all landlords are bastards, even Sisko in this case. They'll leave under falsified transponder signatures in the Defiant. Back on Cardassia, Entak says that Kira, or Ileana, has questions that need to be answered. Gamor is dismissed, but he reminds Entak that he'll be close by. Entek decides to show her evidence to convince her, the cryogenically preserved corpse of Kira Nerys. Entek then recounts a memory of Kira that she never told anyone, proof of an implanted memory. Kira attempts to escape that night, and Gamor walks in, warning her the Order will follow her, and she won't get off of Cardassia. He warns her that the Order is relentless and asks her to watch the recording. She does, and they're of an Ileana in the past, talking to her to prepare herself for her coming home. On the Defiant, they try to use some trickery to sneak past Cardassian ships, but they're told to prepare to be boarded. Garrick tells them to drop their holo filter disguising them as Koberians, and Garrick just straight up swings out a military Cardassian code, which makes the Gull immediately back off and delete all records from his logs. Entek, meanwhile, is interrogating Clara, and it's clear that she is being under some form of torture or duress in this. Mm-hmm. We're not given the specifics. Gamor storms in and forces Entek to stop. Entek warns Kira that the next time he asks questions, it'll be at the Order's facilities. Gamor declares that after he leaves that he'll get her away from Cardassia to protect her from the Obsidian Order. He brings in an officer who, quotes, thinks like he does, unquote, and is going to help her escape. Gamor is in fact part of the dissident movement on Cardassia that is opposed to the military government. Kira, however, feels like something's wrong, and she realized that it's Gamor the Order wants, not her. It's all a trap to get Gamor to reveal himself as a dissident. Entek walks in, and he declares with Gamor gone, they can purge the government. However, Garrick and Sisko then walk in, and they toss a bag into the room, which turns out to be Odo, and Odo just, like, disarms some people. It's really funny, like, when you look at it, it's like,
yeah,
it's like Sisko and... It's like Sisko and Garrick are there to rob a bank, and they toss a bag. It's like, stuff the money in. But Instead, the bag is like, oh, surprise, disarmed from behind by surprise changeling.
It's like, such surprise, a weird slinging. Move. It's so funny.
Yeah.
It's like, why'd you throw a bag? It's like, because we have a secret goo man.
I love when they use Odo creatively like
that. Yeah, no, it's very funny. It's huge RPG player energy.
It, yes, exactly. It has very big, like, we have a shapeshifter, let's get weird with it moment.
Especially because Odo doesn't follow conservation of mass.
No, right, yeah. He's basically a like a Trader Joe's tote that turns into like a big, like a full-sized wet fascist. It makes no sense.
Sisko offers Leia Gamor to come with them, and he agrees. Tech questions why Garak is helping them, and when Entek draws a phaser, Garak just straight up disintegrates Entek.
I love how everybody is fucking flummoxed. Everybody is shocked, and Garak acts like it's a Tuesday.
And he's like, that's a shame. I rather liked him.
I love Garak.
Back on DS9, Kira is back to her old self. The surgery was cosmetic, as it turns out, and she was never a Cardassian, 100% Bajoran. Gamor and Kira question over whether Ileana is still alive, and he is sure that he will find her someday. Kira offers to have Gamor on the station, but he's going to stay with an unaligned government who has offered him sanctuary. Before he leaves, he offers Kira some fatherly advice. Never trust Garak. Kira says that she's happy to have met Gamor despite of the situation, and that she believes he is an honorable man.
I love this episode.
It's so good.
I love this episode, even though Sisko bullies Garak, which I'm not okay with.
I love it. Yeah. Like, Garak is just like, you know.
I mean, don't get me wrong.
I love Sisko bullying everyone. I love honestly.
It. I love it, but also, like, Garak's my boy, so I don't. I'm obligated to not.
Absolutely. You can both love Garak and realize that he absolutely deserves this.
Yeah. No, he absolutely does. And I love how he's like offended that Sisko would dare bully him.
He's like, Commander, this is extortion. And Sisko just pauses. Yeah, it is.
It's very good.
Yeah. And then immediately followed up with Garak saying, if anything happens, you're on your own. And Sisko's like, Mr. Garak, I believe that's the first completely honest thing you've ever said to me.
It's such a good exchange.
And also, I love that it's like, hey, remember a couple of episodes where we had the thing where Cardassians, like, you know, take their people and do plastic surgery to turn them into other species and then, like, establish them as sleeper agents?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hey, remember that?
Mm-hmm. I have questions about this sleeper agent program. I don't understand how this works. They erase their memories, implant new ones, embed them in the society, and then what?
Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. It's fine.
Are they supposed, like, if she had been a real agent, would she have retained some of her memories?
Don't know.
What, like, did she have, like a Talia mode where she would like wake up in the middle of the night and go do spy stuff, or was she supposed to just exist in Bajoran society until they retrieved her and then dump information? I don't understand what they were hoping to achieve.
From the context of this episode, she wouldn't have had any idea what she was. She would have like gone through her regular life, but once they pumped the drugs in her, she would have remembered who she was, and she's like, oh hey, I was the Bajoran liaison officer on DS9. Here is all these state secrets.
Yeah.
Interesting.
One of my favorite parts of this episode is that it is so bananas to me, and I love it, that they picked Kira not because she's liaison officer on Deep Space Nine or any of that. She is picked solely because she's a doppelganger for this guy's daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, as a Bajoran. Like, that's it. Like, they just picked, like, the person who looked the closest. And, like...
And who would not work when they gave the drugs to her.
Yeah. And, like, what a psyop.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's a point where Kira starts believing it. Yeah. Like, almost.
Yeah.
She starts questioning it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a point where I think at the end of this episode, if Kira had not said, Dr. Bashir said my genetics are 100% Bajoran, I mean, there's a real possibility that you can leave this episode with the ambiguity there.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. That said, she makes a pretty good looking Cardassian, I gotta say.
Yeah.
Apparently, Nana Visitor is like extremely claustrophobic and
did not love the makeup.
Did not enjoy those prosthetics.
Yeah, like really did not like the makeup. And like at one point they were like, they had done a 20-hour day of shooting and she just started physically like tearing the makeup off.
Oh, wow.
Which,
yeah. I also like that they claim to have the real Kira's body and they beam it in.
Who knows how you get that?
Well, so here's the thing though. The body they produce looks identical to the photo they have, down to like still being dirty and scruffy, as if they have literally taken this body, this dirty body out of a cell, and like, it seems vaguely off. Like, I looked at the body.
Would you really cleaning the body before you put it into cold storage? Like, you know, the like dirt molecules on there could be useful someday.
I don't know whether you clean a body, like, or, like, I mean, If you're an intelligence agency, I have no idea what you do with a clean body. I have never been in, it's.
I think the question is more like, would the dust and dirt still stick if you had cryogenically frozen it?
I do not claim to know how cryogenics work.
I just, it felt off. Just disgusting.
Yeah, sure.
I also would like to point out.
And like stasis in Star Trek is something different from cryogenics as well.
Yeah. You said it was cryogenically frozen.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I would also like to point out the most sure evidence that we have seen yet that the Cardassians are a failed society. They are using unlabeled data crystal sticks for their data storage.
I mean, Starfleet has those too.
Well, like technically, theoretically, Isolinear chips have a label on them. We just can't read. They have like the weird, they have like the weird Trekkian symbols on them.
Yeah, I mean, like, they do have, like, a place where you can put a label on them, so...
This thing is literally just a glass tube. That's it.
I love this is how... Like, this is the Wikipedia article relevancy test for, like, girl groups, where it's, like, if you look at a girl group and see how many Wikipedia pages the members have, you can determine how relevant they are to our society. This is how you determine a failed Star Trek society, a failed science fiction society is. Do they have unlabelable data storage methods?
Yes.
I mean, it's certainly how I'm measuring it. I really like Tekkini Gamor.
Yes.
I'm on record as really loving the Bajorans, but I am increasingly like enjoying the moral ambiguity of the Cardassians. I'm kind of getting more and more engaged with the Cardassians and their society and stuff. And
there's some interesting autocratic lizards.
I think that there's some interesting things that are done to develop Cardassian, where at first it is they are a nation of evil fascists. Then we see, and then we get a little bit more interested of like, there are people who, there's both people who are not actively evil in Cardassia, but are part of the banality of evil, who are just people who are doing their jobs, which contributes to the violence that fascism.
And that's what we start to get at.
Yeah. And there are people who are actively against that as well. Like, I mean, in Duet, we see people who regret that, even that banality. Yeah. But, and then we see last season, like, there are dissidents and there are people who actively want to try to make Cardassia better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, once we, it's like we go from Duet to profit and loss to this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Basically.
With Star Trek, it's always such a roll of the dice when they leave a plot thread out. Here we have a character who's clearly, like, theoretically useful, narratively speaking. A legate that is now legged off, if you'll pardon the pun, to a politically neutral system because he's part of the dissident faction who has a daughter that is off undercover somewhere. That's a fucking pretty rich plot thread.
Yeah.
But it's Star Trek. So will he come back? Will this plot thread be relevant? Who can say? Throw a dart at the wall. Like,
I am happy to report that Legate Gamor will return.
Dope.
In one of my favorite Kira episodes.
Yeah,
that's exciting.
If you liked Duet, this you'll like this one. Duet in this one, you'll like the next one.
Because I really liked him. I liked the idea of showing. I just like that they're developing Cardassia as more dimensions of Cardassia.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because we have gotten so many of these really absurdly one-dimensional views of Cardassia as this, like, ridiculous police state.
And we're starting to learn more about, like, their literature and stuff like that through Garrick, too.
Yeah.
I think that one of the things that the... It's almost like DS9 does something that I think that, like, really no other series got to do, which is spend time with two alien species and really see a lot of nuance in them. I don't think any other species gets the treatment like the Cardassians and Bajorans. And I think, like, I think at the end of it, I think that the Cardassians come out even three-dimensional than even the Bajorans by the end of the series.
Yeah, the only species that I can think of where they tried to get into, like, that degree of depth over such a long period of time would be the Borg.
Yeah.
Vulcans.
No.
I don't think
Vulcans. Really?
Not really. No. Like, the only time that we see, like, oh yeah, Vulcan society has layers to it is, like, Enterprise. And then we're told, no, that's because they're bad Vulcans.
I feel like... Okay. Interesting.
In my mind, Vulcans have overall become more one-dimensional as Star Trek has gone on.
Interesting. Okay.
I sometimes joke that you can summarize most of the Vulcan characters by just, like, the adjective of emotion Vulcan. Because you have, like, T'Pol, who's the horny Vulcan. And you've got Tuvok, who's the angry Vulcan. And, like, you know, there's that and like... They've really gone very, very, like, to the hilt on, like, Vulcans are arrogant assholes all the time.
Because I like the way that they've been depicting them in Strange New Worlds. The way they've been exploring Spock's Vulcan heritage. And because we've gotten to see a lot of Vulcan culture with his relationship with his fiance.
What I think I'm saying is that more, like, I don't think that Vulcan is depicted as a very, like, three-dimensional society. I think that it, like...
Yeah.
I totally get you.
Yeah.
I totally get you. It makes sense. I mentioned Vulcan because it's been, with Spock on the Enterprise, it's been the alien race that's been a part of Star Trek's narrative for so long. But it's interesting, but you make the good point that it hasn't been the culture we've been with. It's been Vulcan characters. Which is a different thing.
And also, beyond that, they try to make unique as a Vulcan by making a lot of the other Vulcan society and stuff like that more one-dimensional than Spock. Like, that Spock is a very multidimensional character, mm-hmm. and it's like...
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
They try to amplify, like, that Spock is, like, the human Vulcan.
Got it.
But they do that, like, not by kind of relying on the amazingness of Spock, but, like, by being like, well, all the other Vulcans are assholes.
Yeah.
I get you.
Anyway.
Cardassian's interesting, I think, is what I was trying to say here.
Also, for that cryogenically preserved body, like, I was just assuming that that's just, like, you know, a wax model.
Madame Tussaud's Museum of Notable Bajoran Dissidents.
I mean, like, they're great at plastic surgery. So we know that they're great at plastic surgery. So they probably just took, like, some random corpse and were like, let's make it look like Kira. That'll show her.
Yeah, right.
Two funny things. Robert Hugh Wolf said that his inspiration for this episode was reading Philip K. Dick novels. Which is interesting. And not what I would have expected as the primary inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because I was like, if there's anything, I think this is like Le Carré.
Right.
Like spy novels. But the other idea was that it was not Kira originally. It was O'Brien.
Ah, fuck.
But then they ran into a problem of Molly.
Yeah.
Because it's like, wait, no, that his child wouldn't have been. But I thought,
yeah, because that's how they got Seska.
Gosh.
Anything else on this episode?
I like that we get to see a little, like, one thing is just like, I like that we get to see like Cardassian interior decorating and like.
Okay, yes. I fucking love the Cardassian interior decoration. And like, I made a voice memo on my phone to be like, rewatch this episode for like interior decoration inspiration.
I don't know what that.
Okay, that footstool slash coffee table thing. That, yeah, that's. Like that's excellent. That is choice.
All I remember thinking about it was that the desk looked hella 90s, not the rest of the room she was in, but like specifically the little desk thing. It's made of like plexiglass with like a neon, like the classic 90s blue pastel neon colored stuff on it. It was like a transition screen from Saved by the Bell turned into a desk.
And meanwhile, I'm like, this feels like convergent evolution of mid-century modern.
something that I do find interesting is how like all the like the rooms that have like an arc, like they're all arching and like everything going inwards.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that like they want? Here is me saying like maybe they want to feel claustrophobic a little bit because it's like it helps their reptilian brains think like yes, home, nest.
One thing I noted I noted and kind of rolled my eyes at is it's Star Trek, therefore every planet has its one standard like we're on planet X shot. Bajor is special because we've been to like three places on Bajor, so there's like three of those shots. But otherwise, every planet, the matte paintings. Bajor gets two, and that is you get
city
or not, Bajor has a couple, and but Cardassia is unique because Cardassia is a matte painting with a little video in it of a guy talking about doing it for the children.
Yes, you get fascist propaganda videos with your bat paintings.
Yeah. I haven't watched enough TOS to know if that is a TOS artifact or a TNG artifact.
What, the matte paintings?
Yeah.
They've got it in both. And I mean, matte paintings were just a really easy way to just like do those sort of things without, you know, because CGI just wasn't there. And really great way to show like these alien landscapes and stuff.
I love a good matte painting.
Oh my gosh.
But I love that it's become such an iconic part of like the visual language of a Star Trek.
Yeah.
Like when you're on a planet, you have the matte painting. And it kind of irritates me that the modern Treks don't do it.
I wish that, you know, I'm going to become a guy, but just for matte paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you ever find a place where we could get like prints of those, because like I could absolutely go for some like prints of
what a
the
dope
like,
series that would be to have on your walls of like all the cool, like your favorite locations in Star Trek, the map
like,
paintings
in, like,
for them.
In a hallway or like up a stairwell.
I would absolutely buy some high quality prints of like the Bajor mats.
Listeners, if you know where to find these, let us know.
I guarantee they're on eBay or Etsy somewhere. Fucking the internet provides. Let's move on to the next one. For our sins.
All right. This one is episode 6 of season 3, The Abandoned, written by D. Thomas Mayo and Steve Warnock, and directed by Avery Brooks. They can't all be winners, Avery.
God bless you, Avery. You did the best you could.
I mean, he did great stuff with the parts that have Cisco in them.
Yeah.
Generally.
Let's just get through this and we'll talk about the few redeeming things this episode is doing.
All right. So we open in Quarks, where a freighter captain with purple hair is negotiating with Quark for the purchase of some Quadrant salvage.
This lady.
This lady.
This is ear job negotiator lady.
Yeah, no, yes. Here we go. Hello again, hot pirate captain lady who shows up for 45 seconds to throttle my brain senseless.
Quark purchases the salvage, and when he goes to check it out, he hears something strange inside. A wailing infant in a stasis chamber. Ruh-roh, fade to theme music. In the infirmary, Bashir is checking out the infant while Sisko berates Quark about accidentally purchasing a baby. The captain who sold him the ship is long gone, and the identity of the kid is a mystery. He's also growing very fast at rates Bashir hasn't seen outside of a lab. Sisko has a touching moment with the baby, who is making him feel some feelings about the B-plot. And when Sisko returns to the infirmary next day, he discovers that the baby is not a baby anymore. He looks to be about 9 years old and can speak fluently, but doesn't have any knowledge about where he comes from. Bashir's only explanation for this is that the boy must be some product of advanced genetic engineering. We next switch to something completely different as Kira brings a gift of a plant to Odo's new quarters. That's right, he's not living in a bucket behind his desk anymore. Thank you.
I hate this subplot.
He has apparently decorated his quarters as a shapeshifter gymnasium of sorts with lots of things to use for shapeshifting practice. They place the flowers in his old bucket, which he no longer uses now that he has more privacy and less shame about his nature. Good for you, Odo. Bashir, meanwhile, is in the Replimat with Dax, explaining that the boy is missing a critical enzyme, a obvious flaw in his genetic engineering. They're interrupted by chaos at the infirmary. The boy is now roughly teenaged and is becoming clear exactly what species he is. He's a Jem'Hadar.
Bom, bom, bom.
Yep. So the senior staff meet in the wardroom about this development. Sisko announces that the boy is to be taken to Starbase 201 with enthusiastic agreement from Kira, but Odo is uncomfortable with sending the boy to be a laboratory specimen because he has personal experience with that. He takes personal responsibility for the young Jem'Hadar, hoping to nurture the boy's free will and turn him away from the path of senseless violence. The Jem'Hadar is also beginning to suffer from the enzyme deficiency, experiencing nausea and pain. Odo joins O'Brien in searching the salvage, and they find an artifact which appears to hold vials of liquid, which Odo speculates is the missing enzyme. Bashir administers it, and the boy immediately improves. Odo and the Jem'Hadar first go to Odo's quarters, where he explains the purpose of the objects and attempts to deprogram the boy from his insistence that changelings are superior to humanoids. The Jem'Hadar wants to find his people, and Odo shows him footage of the other Jem'Hadar attacking the Defiant. He has an idea for working out the boy's aggression, though. They head to the holosuite where the Jem'Hadar can let loose on simulated opponents. Kira remains skeptical that the boy will ever be anything other than a bespoke murder machine, but Odo is determined to be optimistic and believes that they're forming a genuine bond. But ultimately, the decision of what to do with the Jem'Hadar comes to a head when Starfleet overrides Sisko and sends a ship to take the boy anyway. The ship will reach the station in a matter of hours. At this, the Jem'Hadar decloaks and points a phaser at Sisko, refusing to be sent anywhere by Starfleet. He demands a runabout and that Odo accompany him as he flees, since Odo doesn't belong on Deep Space Nine either. But as Odo continues to insist that they not return to the Dominion, the Jem'Hadar asserts that Odo's time with the other humanoids has changed him somehow away from his true nature. At the airlock, Sisko is waiting for them, but Odo asks him to back down due to the potential for violence. Odo will return with the runabout once he brings the boy back to the Gamma Quadrant. Sisko lets the two go, noting that Starfleet will not be pleased. In the B-plot, we return to Quark's, where an alien with a penis forehead is getting egged on by a... I can't put it any other way. It is just... That's just what it is.
No, I... Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a penis.gif.
He is being egged on by a girl with lots of cleavage until he pushes his luck and loses big. Afterwards, the girl heads over to Jake. She's Marta, the Dabo girl who Jake has been dating. She mentions to Jake that she's looking forward to dinner the next night with Jake and Ben. The existence of this dinner plan is a surprise to Jake, who unsuccessfully attempts to stave off panic. Later, he expresses his annoyance to Sisko, saying that he'd have liked some warning beforehand. We later learn, as Sisko talks to O'Brien, that he doesn't approve of his 16-year-old son's relationship with a 20-year-old Dabo girl, which I can't entirely blame him for, but I'm sure we'll talk about that after this.
Mm-hmm.
Miles asks what Sisko will do if he ends up liking Marta, but Ben is insistent that he doesn't want to like her.
Such a good line.
At dinner, however, Marta seems able to charm even Sisko and introduces him to a side of Jake he's never seen before, a son who's a writer, a poet, and a Damjot hustler. She also calls him out indirectly but unsubtly for his judgment of her based on her job rather than her actual personality, interests, or accomplishments. Later, Ben discusses the evening with Miles. He's warming up to Marta after all and appreciated the new insights into his son.
Okay.
Do we want to talk about the B plot first?
Yeah, let's get the B plot out of the way.
I always try to just like, I always headcanon it that Bajorans are just like a longer lived species.
I think so.
Potentially, but like the age gap is like uncomfortable.
I think the problem is it's the 90s.
When they were like 19, dated someone much older than them. We're not going to go into details of it. It's okay. Here is what I'm going to say. Jake is 16. He is also not attending high school. Like, he's not attending a public high school. I think that, frankly, 20 is like, I can live with this. And
yeah,
it's not as bad as it could be. And
the two of them are really cute together. Yeah. And like, I like Marta a lot.
It is. I think if their relationship was not depicted the way it was, I'd have a lot more problems with it. But it seems like that they are two people who it's like genuinely like each other. It doesn't seem like there's any.
There doesn't seem to be anything predatory about it.
Yeah,
and
like it feels like they're just like hanging out and making out.
I think it's a combination of the 90s not thinking it's a problem that a 16-year-old boy dating a 20-year-old would be problematic, whereas maybe...
It was the 90s that brought us Buffy, where it was like, you know...
A 16-year-old girl
and a 105-year-old dude.
Yeah. Well, immortals are always an exception. They can date any age person they want. Nobody ever seems to have a problem with it. Yeah, I don't know. It feels off. But I think we are a lot more aware of the power dynamics involved in these sorts of age relationships in recent years than we have been in the past.
And also, I would like to point out that Jake is the son of the station commander, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, he is not powerless here. And, you know, he has a solid societal standing on that station.
Yeah, and I think you raise an interesting point that he's not in school. He's very much sort of independent studying, and he's established this relationship on his bona fides as a person. I do like Marta. I agree. I think they establish that their relationship is very much based on mutual respect and not predatory lust. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
It always feels to me like Marta enjoys, like, especially with her job being Dabo Girl, and like her job is distract people with her cleavage and like force them to waste money, basically, or like entice them to waste money. I always feel like she enjoys how chill Jake is, that like they can just hang and like have a nice time and like enjoy each other's company. And it's like, it always seems like, you know, it seems like she's, you know, she enjoys the relationship not because it's like, not for any predatory reason, but because she gets to be chill around him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, and almost in that, like, she almost gets to like reclaim a part of herself that was 16, but like in a detention camp at the time.
Yeah. sort of tangentially related to the B plot. The scene where Sisko sees the baby.
Oh, yes.
And has all these big feels about Jake as a baby.
Yeah.
I've said before that Sisko is an incredibly, like, real depiction of a dad on TV. And I was talking to my wife about this episode before we recorded tonight. And I was trying to explain, like, why he's so good a depiction. Because, like, there's tons of dads on TV. And some of them are fine. But Sisko is a dad clearly written by an actual father who is including in this, like the weird emotional moments of fatherhood that don't always get, that aren't always interesting enough to make it into TV, to add that reality of that lived experience. Because I cannot tell you how fucking real that moment is.
Yeah.
Where he's standing there and he's like, I remember the sleeplessness. I remember the diapers. But I miss that time when he was small enough that I could solve all his problems by picking him up. And when he was that small that I could hold him. I have said those exact words to my wife where it's like, mm-hmm. I wish I could still just like pick up my son and put him on my chest and have him fall asleep. That's such a real, like a real emotion as a father. And I feel that every fucking time I see a kid that's that small. And I think people get Cisco's dadness and how rich it is. But I mean, for me as a father, that hits so hard and it makes me love him so much mm-hmm. because I just really, really feel him in those moments.
There's also the thing I love about it, which is that not only is he just this incredible father character, he's also a black man in the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, having, you know, a black man in the 90s have that like moment of tenderness with the infant and like reminisce about, you know, being mm-hmm. being a father and like feeding Jake and things like that. It's very nice, and like it's yeah. one of the reasons that I love Cisco and love what they did with him and love this, like that particular
yeah
character aspect.
It was so good. I really, really love that. And his whole plot in the B plot with where he's parenting, the line he has where when he's talking to Miles, I really like when him and Miles are dadding. I really love that those interactions. And when he says to Miles, she's a Dabo girl. She's dating my son. I don't want to like her. I'm just like, oh boy, I feel that. Like, like, I just love that moment where he's just like, I'm fully aware of what's happening, Miles. I'm oh, it's so good.
I do like that this is a this is also the first time we will see we'll learn that Jake has sort of a literary talent, which will become a much bigger thing as we go along. But I'm like, this is the first time we ever get it, and the idea yeah. that it's oh no, he has his move is poetry is just like oh
yeah. And it means you were on the right track with that prediction.
I had a couple predictions that kind of came out in this one. That, and I predicted the Jem'Hadar tube was some kind of, like, I don't know. I can't remember exactly what I predicted, but I remember watching it. And when he was like, it's like a chemical they need. And I was like, nailed it.
Yeah.
I love that. We'll get to the Jem'Hadar horse shit in a second. I love that Cisco, like, on learning that his son is a card shark poet.
Sorry.
Pool.
It is
Nausicaan pool.
Okay.
It's the game that Picard was hustling when he got stabbed through the heart.
Okay. That's even better. When he learns his son is a pool shark poet that has, you know, has enough riz to land a, you know, a smart and intelligent Dabo girl, you can see he's so proud. And I love that. I love that about him. Oh, yeah. Where it's like,
you know,
he's like, already,
you know what?
Accepted.
I can't be mad because my son has game.
Yeah. He's like, he's accepted that Jake's not going to go into Starfleet, which was such a big moment for them. And now he's like looking at Jake and he's like, I don't know what this kid's going to do, but he's got some game. So I feel like he's going to be okay. And I love that moment. I love that moment where he's like, oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's such a good dad moment.
You can clearly tell that between the dinner party and him talking to O'Brien later, he's also actually played Dom Jot with Jake. Because when like,
and
when he's like to O'Brien, like,
back. Yeah.
Have you ever played Dom Jot with him? And O'Brien's like, no. He's like, don't.
Have I told you that I am descended from a pool hustler?
You have not.
I am oddly unsurprised by that. That sounds like a thing that you would say that, you know, you learn things about people and you're like, yeah, tracks.
Yeah. So my great grandpa Lee, when I call him a bastard, I mean it in like affectionate way. So my great grandpa, Lee, survived the Great Depression through, playing minor league baseball. Then once he did that, got kicked off a reservation, then went to New Orleans and boxed and hustled pool to survive the Great Depression before, as I'm told, mysteriously vanishing as soon as World War II happened.
That's a character.
He is like, you know, knew him when I was much younger, but yeah, no, a bastard. Mm-hmm. And I mean that affectionately.
Yeah, bastard, quote, you know, brackets, affectionate.
Yeah. My dad learned about the pool hustling part as a teenager, when he scored like a paycheck off of my dad when he was a teenager.
Grandpa bamboozled him for a paycheck. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right. I said my piece about, I've had my moment about the dad stuff. Let's talk about this dumb Jem'Hadar plot.
I want to like the idea of it, that it's like we are trying to push back against, like, it's nature nurture, and man, it's a crack baby thing.
Here's what I'll say about it. I liked the idea that Odo immediately empathized with another orphan who is destined to be a lab rat. And he is like, not on my fucking watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he recognizes that by dint of what he is, he has a certain responsibility to this kid. And he steps up in such a big way. And he wants so badly to give this kid better than he got, that he's willing to throw his life away to save this kid. And
yeah. Like, he's willing to just run off to the Gamma Quadrant, or like run off to like some random planet and like try to make a life with this kid so that, you know, so that he doesn't have to be a lab rat.
Yeah. So he doesn't have to be a lab rat and doesn't have to be a death commando.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that is such an interesting subplot. It's a real shame that they waste it on, as Justin said, this crack baby metaphor, who is going to run straight back to the Jem'Hadar. And I want to believe that there's too many Borg.
Yeah, no, you
parallels, like, going on here.
Yeah, you have to, like, I think even if it's not intentional, you sort of have to compare it to that, where it's the difference between them is that Borg, there's a significant space of time between Best of Both Worlds and Borg, which there weren't any Borg appearances between those two episodes. And how the entire episode is about, like, showing that, like, you can pull.
Yeah.
Borg is almost like deprogramming a cult member.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's no hint of that in this one.
Yeah, no, there isn't. And the whole thing of it is that, like, you know, Borg, it is about, you know, like, finding the humanity on somebody who has been part of a terrible thing and brought back, you know. But this one, this guy is the Jem'Hadar is unrepentant.
He's more of a robot than Hugh ever is.
Yes.
Yeah.
He has no conception of the idea that he could be anything other than a killing machine. And he doesn't even understand that he's being offered another choice by Odo, and no interest in it. And at the first opportunity, he runs back to the Jem'Hadar.
And the moment where, like, he looks at, like, Odo, like, who's been trying to, like, tell him, you know, who's been trying to be like, no, this doesn't have to be your path, and is like, man, I don't know what these fuckers have done to you, but you ain't right.
Yeah.
Yeah. like I said, I mentioned I wrote Borg because like it's hard. You have to draw parallels there.
Oh, yeah.
But I hope they don't bring this kid back because I don't want this plot ever to come back.
Do I have good news for you?
Good. I want there, I'm sure they will deal at some point in the future with, like, I don't know, I'm not sure. I would hope that they will try and do a little bit of nuance with the Jem'Hadar sometime in the future.
Yes.
But maybe not. Maybe the Jem'Hadar are just destined to be mindless robots.
It's
going to
be
know.
A while before we get back to this.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's their next, it'll be something that'll be tackled.
The next time they look at the drug that the Jem'Hadar are on is actually going to be, it's going to be like almost exactly a season later.
Mm.
It's a very interesting episode, and I think that what they do is really good. And I think the subsequent questions they have about soldiers who are created to be loyal to an authoritarian government, who are designed to be addicted to a drug, who worship their rulers as gods, that's all going to be stuff that they do very interesting things with.
Any inferences that you make about their lifespan based off of the rapid development are correct, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But
They're child soldiers.
Yes. It's a lot more interesting. They really haven't figured out what questions they want to ask at the Dominion yet.
Yeah, the whole thing with the Dominion, even at this point, feels, up until this point, the Dominion has been a thing where it hasn't even been a thing until the last set of episodes, and it's felt half baked, and I'm looking forward to it being, and maybe it won't even be fully baked until the Dominion War starts. Cause I know that's coming at some point in the future. But it definitely, this episode in particular, feels very much like somebody took the cake out of the oven and the middle's still liquidy. Like it's not even half baked. It's like it needs another hour. You know what I mean?
The middle is still shapeshifter goo.
Yeah, it's still wet fascist in the middle.
I would agree with that. There is...
Yeah.
I will be honest, they don't really... It is not really until, the end of the season that they even figure out what they want, what emotions they want the Dominion to evoke.
Yeah.
Which, once they figure it out, I think it's really good. But, unfortunately, they don't really quite get it yet.
This season is pretty much just, the threat looming over the station, yeah, and casting a pall over everything there.
Yeah. Okay. There's going to be a good two-parter towards the end of the season about responses to the Dominion. But yeah, we're not really gonna see it until the real end of the season, which I think is just, I don't think they really need, I think it's weird because the thing that they do best in season 3 is establish the station and its family dynamic and the relationships there. And it almost feels like something you would have wanted to do in the past season before introducing this big threat. It's weird. I think it's one of the few things that doesn't work. And I think, I will be honest, I think this episode, along with an episode that we're going to do in the next recording, Meridian, are the two weakest episodes of the season.
Yeah, for sure.
That is not the worst thing you could say about a TV show, because this is not a terrible episode of television.
No, it's fine.
It's rough, and it's not the worst thing I've... But, if this is the worst that it gets this season, that's not... There have been some real...
I would classify Meridian as worse, but only because it is just the definition of a nothing burger. We'll see when we get there.
But seasons 1 and 2 had had much lower lows than this episode.
There, I think there's going to be episodes that you, Jude, personally will hate. There's one in particular I'm thinking about. There's
you're telling me right now that there's going to be an episode that's all about Kieran Odo, and I hate that you're telling me that.
Okay, okay. I want to say something here because, okay, I know that you hate the Kira Odo ship, and that's okay. Like, I'm not fond of it
either.
Is it
shipping when the show is doing it?
Oh,
and but
it's still a ship. Even.
I will say, I really like their friendship. Like,
but they're not friends. Show is making her flirt with him, and it's gross, and I'm not into it.
No, at this point, I feel like she's just like showing up at his quarters with a housewarming plan because it's nice. Yeah.
No, they are not friends. This is not friendly moves. That she was giving him some distinctly unfriendly eyes in both of these last couple episodes, and I'm not into it.
Nah.
He put her flowers in his weird oatmeal pot.
But that's not a friendly gesture.
Yeah. That's nice though, because it's like something growing out of like a thing that he was ashamed that like represents his shame.
It is nice. If she hadn't been giving him fuck me eyes the whole time, it would have been a lovely moment of personal growth. But she wasn't. And then she's offended that he let his weird Jem'Hadar,
You've got the wrong read on that, buddy.
At this point in the series, what I read it as is that they are friends, like that they are good friends, and they have a relationship that is nebulously defined. And I think the only if there is romantic, I think it is only from Odo's, like this is only from Odo's side at this point. And I don't even think that's really there. I think that is something that Renee, I don't think actively written. I think they are friends right now, and Renee is playing something up. That is how I've always taken this.
Yeah.
See, yeah, that's not how I'm reading it, but I'm encouraged that you're saying that because you guys have actually seen the show. So yeah, if you're saying that there's not romantic.
The textual evidence supports that like they are just friends at this point, and like there might be some acting decisions, but like in general, they're meant to be close friends who care about each other. And like, you know, you just hate Odo.
I hate Odo a lot less than I have in recently. Episode, I didn't hate him at all in this episode, except for the flirting part. Like, I liked him in this episode, the way he was trying to prevent.
I really like the part where she like stops in at his quarters, because especially with the search part 1 and 2, where she's there kind of in the background as he's like discovering his
identity. No, I totally got that.
Like
that.
And like being like, you know, he invites her in and is like, I'm using this to like further the exploration that I started on the planet when you were there. And she,
yeah, like, I'm making my own little weird garden place. Like, I get that. I like that fine. I just didn't like the weird fuck me eyes that were going on when he's putting her flowers in his oatmeal pot. I'm not into that. I wasn't about it.
I think you're reading something into Nana Visitor's performance that was not intended.
Well, whether she intended it or not, it was unwanted. My notes as I was watching this episode were, Kira, I fucking swear to God, stop flirting with Odo. I cannot emphasize this enough. Go back to fucking boring Bajorans. That's what I got from her performance.
Okay. So next time we are going to,
that's how we're
next
ending
time,
it.
Jude will continue Kira to be go, wrong.
We are going to be next time we're going to be covering 2 episodes. One of which is the greatest meme episode of Deep Space Nine. And the other is one of the episodes of Deep Space Nine. Join us next time for episodes 7 and 8, Civil Defense, and Meridian. Until next time, Bajoran workers, your attention please. Next time we will cover episodes 7 and 8 of season 3. Your compliance and viewership of this these episodes is mandatory. You have 1 week. Just keep circling. Just keep circling.
The Babylon Project is an independent production. All views expressed on the show are our own. Clips from the original show remain property of the original owner. Music information can be found in the show notes. The rest of the show is licensed under a Creative Commons 4.0 share alike no derivatives license.